Welcome back, folks. It's good to have you all here with us. We are now going to take a look at what happened in New York yesterday, but more than that, we're going to look at where this is taking, not just this election, but I think where the American body politic, is moving. And I think in very fractious ways, but it says a lot if you take a long-range view of who we are as America and Americans. Catalina Byrd, media consultant, political strategist, remains in studio with us. We're joined by Arun Gupta, who is an investigative reporter whose work has appeared in dozens of publications, like The Guardian, Salon, The Nation, and a book that we have not interviewed him for yet, but we are going to do in the coming weeks, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, A Junk Food-Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. And Arun, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Eugene Craig is with us, a grassroots activist and third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. Good to have you here as well.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Pardon me. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Pardon me. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And you can also email us at talkatsteinershow.org and be on our website as well. Sorry, I got something caught in my throat. I apologize. So, Arun, good to have you back with us. So let me just start with you. And just let's get pure politics for a second, and what really happened in New York, and why when people thought that Bernie was surging. I have some theories about that, but let me let you kick it off.
Well, I think the Bernie was surging was just wishful thinking. You know, personally, I think what Bernie Sanders says is great, but the Clintons have deep roots here. There's a lot of machine party politics. New York is a big union state, and so all the major unions have endorsed Clinton. Only a few smaller ones have endorsed Sanders. Clinton has shown generally a significant strength among African-American and Hispanic voters, and also 60% of the voters yesterday in the Democratic primary were women. So this all played to her strength. You know, if you looked at the aggregate of the polling data, Clinton was consistently ahead 10, 13, 14 points. It appears she, in fact, outperformed a little bit. And I think it needs to be sobering, you know, not really so much for a Sanders campaign. I wrote a year ago that it would effectively be over after Super Tuesday. I think this is more for left and progressive. It's just like, look, you can't organize a movement state by state with only 1 to 2 weeks at a time. This is something that takes years and years of serious hard work to do. And while Sanders has done better than anyone thought he would do, even himself, according to a New York Times article a few weeks ago, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. As for Trump, it's simple. New York has been his state, his home ground, so he was always going to do well here.
Good, Gene, and then we'll go to Kat.
You know, I think it came down to one thing only. Bernie Sanders does amazingly well when there's independent voters in open primaries. This is a closed primary.
Michigan was open.
Michigan was open. This was a closed primary. Iowa was open. This was a closed primary. New Hampshire was open. This was a closed primary. Bernie Sanders does amazingly well when you have open primaries. Hillary, I mean, when you look at the raw vote total compared to the total number of voters, she only won by 280,000 to 290,000 votes. You open up that primary to the other 3 million independents that, you know, would have swung overwhelmingly for Bernie. He won in New York.
And there's some similarities to Maryland that there are to New York.
We're a close
primary, but also he won almost all of the counties. She won where the dense population was, similar to how you win the state of Maryland if you win PG in Baltimore. So you can lose in these other counties in like southern Maryland and things. Those same things apply there. But what was interesting that I was following and why I was up till 4 a.m., Mark Steiner, is because they have something that we don't, which was the same-day registration piece. And so what they were interviewing people, and I found very interesting because I've been saying on EAA for some weeks now, Hillary Clinton does well in the same places that Donald Trump does. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I believe have the same base, which also scares me, is you had Democrats switching to Republican yesterday to vote for Trump because that's how much they dislike Clinton and Sanders. That's very, very telling. About what that electorate is and who it is and what it looks like and who her base is. While everybody's trying to act like she's the anti-Trump, she's actually the person who is identical to Trump in the way that this race is being ran and won.
Yep.
So, Aaron, it's interesting. Between just sticking with New York again, obviously, for a moment, given the polling irregularities that go anywhere from 28,000 to 127,000 people that were denied the right to vote in Brooklyn especially, taking place in New York, and who knows where that vote would have gone. Yep. It's hard to say. And the fact that the independents were denied just the day before in court to be able to vote in the primary. What that says about the tenor of this race?
Well, you know, as a representative of a state party, every state party has, you know, the right to open or close their primary. You know, something that we debate in the Maryland Republican Party every election cycle. But I think, you know, party members, you know, especially party activists, I think there's a real argument to be made that, you know, the folk that are, you know, part of the party should be the ones picking the party's nominees. You want to help pick our nominee, you should join the party.
So, I'm sorry. Yeah. And how do you see that playing out? How do you see it played out in New York yesterday?
Well, when you yelled at us, the Trump win and the Clinton win.
I'm trying to get Aaron to answer the question.
Sorry.
Well, look, I think, you know, the problem is that we all grew up with this mythology of democracy and an open system, and you just need to vote and your voice is heard. Where the two parties are private corporations. That's why we have in so many states, you're not voting for a candidate, you're voting for a delegate. And even when you're voting for a delegate, they may just be the delegate at a county convention who then chooses delegates for a state convention, who then at the state convention choose delegates for the national convention. It's these arcane, it's deliberately arcane and Byzantine systems to put the power in the hands of those who control the party, which are politicians and their wealthy benefactors, you know, the 1% who run the political system. So I don't think there's anything unusual about this at all. It's just we need to have a better understanding of what's going on. At the same time, I wouldn't get too caught up in these purges. You know, it does raise a lot of eyebrows, but as an investigative reporter, what I found is like just incompetence or sloppiness often accounts for most of what looks as sinister. There does appear to be some really shady things going on, apparently with entire buildings being purged, but this would not have made a difference in any case. Clinton overwhelmingly took the African American vote by 3-1, and Brooklyn is an incredible historic place, and folks should remember it's sometimes referred to as the capital of Black America because you have over a million African Americans who live in Brooklyn. So even if there was something sinister with this purge, which we have no evidence of, it doesn't mean that it would have swung things anyway, and certainly not with Clinton winning by 16 points. And I get back to my earlier point, you know, the people, Bernie Sanders' fervent supporters, need to think about, you need to build power outside the electoral system if you're going to really affect the electoral system. The last great liberal president was Richard Nixon.
Wow.
Yes, on some levels that's true. I mean, in terms of his issues around the environment, what he did there, not necessarily what he did with the drug war, but in terms of around the environment, other issues, he pushed things EPA that have made a remarkable change in this country.
Clean Water, Clean Air, Endangered Species Act, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, wage and price controls. He instituted an affirmative action plan. He proposed a national health care plan. He even at one point proposed a national income. You don't get much more socialist than that. And that's because the left was powerful. That's because you also had a public that believed government could do good things. They hadn't been poisoned by the right and Reaganism to hate the government.
I don't think everybody's been poisoned to hate the government at this point. If you, depending on where you are, the government has done great things and the government has done terrible things.
Absolutely.
And unless you either just don't know where to get the information or the facts, or you are listening to someone else, possibly one of us on the air, and not doing the research for yourself, do you just believe what you've heard? But I think that the turnout for all of these candidates shows that people are not poisoned to the government, whether you agree or disagree with what the rhetoric is and the mantra that's getting those people out. People are engaged. People are paying attention on every level. And so I think that speaks to the American spirit as it relates to democracy and patriotism. People want to be involved in this process. They're saying, if my vote never counted before, we're going to make sure it does this time because we're going to show up in such large numbers that you can't make it disappear.
Well, I think that, though, Aaron has a point, but that I think especially on the Republican side of the ledger and the people who are more conservative, that they do now have this view, unless it's the Pentagon, that something's wrong with the government, that we have too much government other than the Pentagon. I think that's the mythology, because you have – that's why people – it's so weird to watch Trump, because he speaks about how terrible things are and how horrible the government is. The same hand, he's kind of trying to play both ends against the middle in his conversations. But he's playing on this hatred of minorities, hatred of black and Latino people, and the fear among white people – of where America's going. I mean, that's where you see this kind of spread taking place.
Let me tell you, you will never ever catch me anywhere defending the bigotry coming out of Donald Trump. You know, it's not conservative, it's not liberty oriented. It's authoritarian bigotry. He doesn't, you know, he's. Doesn't represent Republican values. He doesn't represent conservative values.
He wasn't even a Republican.
You know, I actually, over the last week, I've, publicly endorsed John Kasich. I think, our party needs to put up somebody that actually is governed, that actually knows how to unite people and bring folk together without using divisive rhetoric or marginalizing people or otherizing people. What Donald Trump has done to our political system, granted, it was, screwed up before, but, took it into hyperdrive.
Before I turn to Aaron for this comment, I may ask you this question, Gene, since you raised this issue. I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. And could you, as a Republican, support Donald Trump if he was nominated as president of your party?
I will support the Republican nominee, and I am doing
Trump.
And I am doing everything I possibly can to make sure it's not Trump.
Interesting. So, and Aaron, to pick up on that point, just because I think that what you're seeing with independents in this country, what you're seeing with the Sanders vote, what you're seeing with Trump's vote, and the complexities of progressives and people on the left kind of supporting Trump, but masses of older African-American and Latino voters supporting Clinton. We're at a very, I think, interesting moment in history. We don't know what the next 20 years are going to bring, but the rumbling here, to me, deserves a serious analysis.
Yeah, well, I think this country is essentially moving towards what I call a soft apartheid system. America has always been marked by apartheid, first slavery, then Jim Crow, and once a legal segregation ended, it was very quickly replaced by the war on drugs and the mass incarceration, especially of African Americans, what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. But now, with the decline in life expectancy among white working class middle-aged folk, we're seeing, we're reaping 40 years of neoliberal policies. And so people are being segregated and attacked according to income and race, and the right is also very effectively still waging a culture war, now with these bathroom bills. I travel all over the country, and you really see this disjuncture. There's incredible wealth out there, places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, New York, the cities in the Pacific Northwest. And then you can just go, miles away. In fact, sometimes even in the own neighborhood, like places like New York, you can have people living in desperate poverty next to a building filled with $5 and $10 million condos. And this disparity, this type of kind of soft apartheid based on economics, technology, and identity is creating a tremendous amount of anger on both the left and right. So we have one politician who's saying, hey, this is about policies and the systems. That's Bernie Sanders. You have another politician who say it's, hey, blame the person next to you, the Mexican immigrant, the Muslim, you know, or the Chinese person. So it is very ugly, and I think Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are very different. I don't like a lot of these analysts who try and make them sound the same,
right,
but they
right.
are responding to the same conditions in a lot of ways with very different answers. And again, I think Bernie Sanders is offering a much more intelligent response than Donald Trump, but this is not going to go away. And as a final note, I've heard recently from friends who are Democratic Party stalwarts who are happy that it appears Trump is going to be the nominee. And all I can say is, like, oh, man, do not wish for this, because he's not just revealing.
Right.
This is what people think, that he's just revealing something that already exists. That's absolutely not true. He's also bringing into force something new. The fact that he is legitimizing open white supremacists, open neo-Nazis, that he's legitimizing this hatred, means that we will see Trumpism will outlive Trump. And I know
true.
Your guests may not like this, but the fact of the matter is the Republican Party has been the party of whites for a long time. Mitt Romney's base was about 90% white, and this is in America that's just going to keep browning and browning more. It's now about one-third people of color. And if you look at the Republicans have pushed them all away, whereas 30 years ago, the Asian American vote, those very small, would split evenly between Republicans and Democrats. It's now going 3-for-1 for Democrats. Certainly after Trump, this may be a historic shift, just like the 1960 election was. Republicans could still count on significant African-American support as a party of Lincoln. But after 64 with Barry Goldwater, they opened their doors wide and took in the Dixiecrats and became the party of white anti-black racism.
Well, that's not true at all. That's not true at all. We're a party for everybody.
I know you have your opinion. Okay?
Well, in fact, we've had 3 black lieutenant governors in the state of Maryland, 2 of them Republican. We produced the first black U.S. senator from the South since Reconstruction, Tim Scott. I mean, we produced a black congresswoman out of Utah. I mean, the argument that the Republican Party is a racist party is a myth.
Upper echelon of your party as you like, but that does not... counter the fact that the policies the Republican Party...
But the policy of school choice, of economic empowerment...
Let me finish. We just had that recent piece in Harper's where you have the architect of the war on drugs admitting outright that this was to attack African Americans. The Reagan administration was all about blame.
And we have the wife of mass incarceration running for president as a front runner.
I was a kid, and I remember very well in high school just the vicious coded racism. You know, the whole Southern strategy, 1988. And
super predators?
Important. The Republican Party has always, for the last 50 years, has been the party of white resentment and white racism.
That is absolutely hogwash.
Well, why is every single person of color group fleeing your party? Why is your party virtually nothing but whites anymore?
What do you mean? You know, Ileana Roth Latham, Marco Rubio?
It's a simple fact that Republicans can actually survive white nationalism. And maybe you don't like that, but that is...
It's not true.
Let me just jump in here so we get some other... I understand what you're saying, Gene and Kat, what you're about to say, but I don't see how...
I didn't say anything. How can you understand what I'm about to say?
He knows you. He knows you.
But, I mean, I think what Aaron's saying, how can anyone deny the fact that the Dixiecrats of the Democratic Party, the most racist element in the Democratic Party, are now Republicans, that they are fueling, that they push the party further to the right in racist ways. They're still doing it. Around this country with Trump and with Cruz, because Republicans elect one or two people who are black to a position, part of that has to do with assuaging the white racists, some of the folks who do vote for them in the first place. I mean, how can we deny that?
So what's being missed is the actual analysis of policy. What you're judging the party, who I'm not a member of, based on the rhetoric of some. But when you look at the policies, I let you speak for a very long time. So when you look at the policies and direct implications they have on the economy, especially in urban communities where black people live, we have always been doing better under Republican administrations, regardless of what the rhetoric was.
How do you say that?
All substantial legislation that has alleviated any barriers, with the exception of the Barack Obama administration, has come from Republicans.
How that happened under Bush or Reagan?
Morgan State University, Coppin State University, the buildings that were
sitting in from a Republican governor.
Bob Early,
was a
Michael
one-term
Steele.
Governor. the civil rights legislation. Oh, Lincoln freed the slaves, and when you juxtapose that with the party who has figured out how to methodically maintain the brainwashing of the black electorate, the Democrats. NAFTA, whose jobs did those take? They took our jobs. They impacted our community.
Let me just tell you guys.
Mass incarceration.
All of you, just wait a minute. Stop. Aaron, everybody stop. We cannot have a... Aaron, let me just jump in. We can't have a free-for-all. Nobody can hear a thing.
It's true.
Okay?
It's true.
So, if we're going to get this out, but I mean... Well, I mean, so I heard what you said. Eugene, give me your thoughts.
I'll bring this to 2016. The reason we're talking about criminal justice reform isn't because Bernie Sanders stood in the Florida Senate and waved his hands. Isn't because Patty Murray stood in the Senate and waved her hands. Isn't because Jean Shaheen stood in the Senate and waved her hands. It's because we have folk like Mike Lee in 2011 pushing. It's because we have folk like Rand Paul in 2011 pushing
please.
It. It's because we have folk like Justin Amash teaming up with John Conyers and pushing it. You know, and bringing it to the forefront and bringing it mainstream.
Rand Paul, who said,
absolutely.
I would not have signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That Rand Paul.
We're not going to address that tonight.
Well, I had issues with Rand, and Eugene knows absolutely. This. I was not in support of Rand,
but I understood why he was.
Let me just jump in. So, I mean, Aaron, we have to go to break here in a minute, but to me, it's not any of these Republicans who raise the issues or the Democrats. It's Black Lives Matter that raise the issues that push this country. Not Republicans or Democrats.
Exactly. And it happened under a black president, which I think is significant. But let me just throw out one last point. Like, look, this is some of the stuff that I study closely in terms of my reporting. If you go back and you look at actually all the kind of quality of life, black economic progress, blacks, their economic status relative to the rest of the population peaked in the mid-late 70s. That's coming out of we see like significant growth in economic income and a little growth in wealth coming out of the 60s, out of the Great Society programs. Then they're reversed. Under the Reagan administration, they improve again under the Clinton administration, and then we see the enormous destruction of wealth with the fraudulent subprime mortgage crisis. And don't, you know, I don't want to hear anything about like, oh, it was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They were, or the community reinvestment program. They were behind the curve. It was the banks, and that was a bipartisan policy. You know, I'm not a partisan here, okay? That was bipartisan, but it also did happen under George W. Bush, and Obama actually made it worse. His home mortgage plan was a disaster. I think there's plenty of blame to go on the Democrats, but as you would have to be dumb, deaf, and blind to ignore the way that the Republicans have ginned up racial resentment for the last 50 years.
We do have to take a quick break here and come right back to conversation and come over to Catalina Byrd to respond, and Gene Craig and the rest of you. Do join us here, 410-319-8888. You can get a word in edgewise, I promise. 410-319-8888. We'll be back for the rest of our conversation.
Wow.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with our guests in a rip-roaring conversation about where we're going in this country. Catalina Byrd, media consultant, political strategist. Arun Gupta, investigative reporter for numerous publications, The Guardian, Salon, The Nation, and many, many more. Author of Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, A Junk Food-Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. And Eugene Craig III, who is grassroots activist and third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Let me go right to the phones, Mike, folks, and get some calls in here. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I had a question that I would like to ask your panel to address about the sort of the flow of history in America being on a path where the empire impulse is sort of becoming more dominant, sort of a top-down management type approach, a sort of force approach. And after all these election results, we're in the Empire State. So I just wanted to ask your panel to maybe address that issue.
I don't quite understand the question.
Okay. Well, in history, there have been repeated empires where there's sort of, control exerted from a center. It could be economic, political. And America seems to be, since World War II, sort of riding that current, if you will. And so the fact that you have somebody like Trump who is exerting sort of a very strong man approach, it sort of plays into that impulse. And I see that as being consistent with a type of historical direction. It could be a softer or harder, and he's a type of harder empire-leaning person, it seems.
Okay.
Donald Trump is an authoritarian, and, I guess to answer your question in the most simplest of terms, free market capitalism, free market enterprise has raised the standard of living of everyone on this planet within the last 200 years.
Except and for the 2 billion people who all live on a dollar a day or the majority of African Americans in this country who've lost all their wealth.
Well, I think that's arguable. That's arguable for
them. What's arguable?
It's arguable.
What's arguable?
I mean, you look at a sandwich. You look at something like a sandwich. And I want to get into a whole discussion on what it would take, in today's term to produce something like that, and how, trading and free market capitalism has allowed us to speed up that process and whatnot. But Donald Trump, as an authoritarian, as an economic authoritarian, would be horrible for this country. And I think, we all need to be doing everything we possibly can to stop him.
That I agree with to an extent. So to the caller's point, I guess he's saying, I think he was trying to say history repeats itself. And in what window of history are we looking at in a Donald Trump? And I hope I'm interpreting him correctly. And so I think we've all seen the comparisons to a Hitler. But what it you said something, Mark, earlier that really struck me, in that some people are saying that he is bringing light to a part of the party that I think that we all already knew was there. I think they came out of the woodwork, for those that didn't know they were still there, after the election of President Obama, in the support of the Tea Party and the caucus. And the rhetoric has been amping up since 08. And he saw that moment and the ability to capitalize on that, coming from a media background and understanding that sensationalism sells in this way that we consume media now. And
that's
this true. With technology and a 24/7 news cycle. And so he knew he didn't have to be genuine. He knew he didn't have to be factual. He knew he didn't have to be smart. All he had to do was say things that made them the amen choir or the church choir say, yes, he's the guy. And that's what he's done.
But I think also the part of the dynamic here in this election, which I find interesting, because there's all kinds of contradictions here to me. On the one hand, we have I'm just taking the long view here, not what's going to happen tomorrow morning, but the long view. You've got this very strange dynamic where you have a majority of the progressive white left voting for Bernie Sanders, and much of the older black and Latino vote fueled by women voting for – pulled by women and women of color voting for Hillary Clinton.
Which I've been against for quite some time.
I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. And that – to me – That's one of the strange things that it's about where the Democratic Party has been for the last 50 years, which has been the only institution politically in America that has opened its doors to people of color to have power inside the party to be able to push things, and fearing that loss without an alternative.
Yep.
And I think and so I think that there's a lot of kind of internal contradictions, and the question is – What does this arc say? And let me start with Aaron very quickly and go through everybody in the room here. What does this say about the arc of where the politics may be going over the next 10 or 15 years in America? And we also see the pulling apart from the very right and very frightened white working class community in America pulling to the right, except for those who are unionized, who are still on the left for the most part. So, I mean, this is a – I think this is a very strange moment that I think only to kind of determine where this is going. And I don't mean for the next election. I mean for the future.
Well, both parties are in a deep bind. I think one thing we can say about it, definitely it's going to be Hillary Clinton, and it's looking like it's going to be Donald Trump. Here's the thing. Hillary Clinton, I think, represents a realignment, the final part of a realignment for the Democratic Party. When the Clintons came into power in 1992, and your listeners will understand when I say I am not partisan, they did so also appealing to Southern white racism. There was the Sister Soldier moment with Jesse Jackson. There was we're going to get tough on crime. We're going to end welfare. There was, Bill Clinton going back to Arkansas to execute a mentally handicapped black man, a man who was so mentally handicapped, he saved part of his dessert from his last meal because he didn't understand. He saved it under his pill because he didn't understand he was being executed. So the Clintons have very much been on the forefront of the Democratic Party attacking the working class. Hillary Clinton is going to run to the center, going to try to appeal to Republican moderates, Republican women. And they're kind of abandoning the working class, and this is going complemented by the right to work legislation that we see in the historic heartland of union strength. States like Michigan, what John Kasich tried to do in Ohio. So the Democrats are solidifying this advantage at the presidential level. If Hillary Clinton wins this election, which if it's against Trump, she will do. The Democrats will have won six out of the last seven national elections, but they're cutting off their own base by the fact that they keep attacking the working class. The dilemma for the Republicans, and we saw Donald Trump flirting with this, which was essentially social welfare for whites. You know, as we know, the guy has been in the past pro-single payer. His stuff about against the free trade bills and bringing manufacturing back is an attempt to allay white working class concerns about a declining economy. But the problem is both parties are joined at the hip at Wall Street. So the Republicans do have a path forward in terms of trying to appeal to the white working class, but they're not going to appeal to the social welfare aspect that many in the white working class want. Whereas for the Democratic Party, they're going to try and consolidate the center. But they are committing a slow suicide by basically undermining their own political base, the unions and labor movement, and of all colors that have provided them for strength going back to the 1930s.
Okay, so there's some truth in that to the extent that the Democrats are cutting themselves off. The issue is that I don't believe that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, that she beats Donald Trump he becomes the nominee.
But no, every poll in the country says that's taking place.
Well, you know how I feel about polls, but I keep
wait. His negatives are phenomenal.
This guy never stops talking. So in 08, the only thing that the base that we've all agreed that Clinton and Trump share is the only thing that white nationalists hate more than people of black and brown skin is women. This is why she lost in 08. This is why you had Democrats switching it to Republican yesterday in New York to vote for Donald Trump in some very key places because they are a closed primary state. When you look at the pathology, I've said it 1,000 times over the 10 years that I've been on the air, sexism runs deeper than racism. And when it gets to that same base that they share and they get to choose between the guy that they may or may not believe. And the only reason the flip-flopping doesn't hurt him the way it did Mitt Romney is, again, because he is a sensationalized caricature of himself. So Mitt Romney wasn't just – he wasn't charismatic. He wasn't a cartoon. His flip-flops were easier and his gaffes were easier to pinpoint and point out because he was very kind of subtle. Donald's saying crazy stuff literally every day.
Which is why he can't win, I think.
The thing is this.
No, I think it is why he wins.
The thing is this. Donald Trump has an irate minority within a minority party. A majority minority party. You know, when you have a field of 17 people, you get a solid 15, 20% of them to make some noise. It makes it like, you know, you're running the show. And, you know, what we've seen here is somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy over the last couple months. As folk, you know, dropped out and the field dwindled down, you know, Donald Trump got stronger. But, you know, it started with a small, irate minority. And it's still, to a large degree, a small, irate minority. I'm a Kasich supporter, and I can only imagine, you know, where it would be if, you know, John Kasich pulled, you know, if he was able to pull the same 25% he pulled last night in New York, you know, earlier in the game.
I mean, I think that that we're in such a divided place, and I do agree about one thing you said, Kat. I think sexism runs extremely deep in this culture, and as Valerie, my wife, would say, that's why she thinks Hillary can't win. And I disagree with her as well.
I knew I always liked your wife more. I mean, because it's bigger than America. It's global. King James rewrote the Bible. He disliked his first wife so much. I mean, if you look at the history of sexism, it runs almost as deep as the pathology of what whiteness is since they created and who they let be white in their terms. You know, the acquisition of power and the maintaining of power are two different skill sets, and they adapt to maintain power.
I think, though, that the fear factor around Trump is enough to put Hillary over the top. And it's also
– I agree.
There's no indication when you look at – as I think Aaron was trying to say, there's no – when you look at all the presidential election cycle leans towards Democrats, not Republicans, at this moment in our history. And it's just it's not going back in this election.
I will say this. The weakest of plans, the weakest of policies look great up against – it's going to be great and we're going to have lots.
Right, and the pendulum always swings back and forth, and then the question becomes, and I don't know that the answer is Trump. Are they more afraid of Trump or Mexicans?
I got to jump in because we're almost out of time here, and I don't have a 30-second piece here. A tweet just came in from Analysis, the poet saying, the Republican champions racist policy, in ones of the ones of color in guests mentioned notwithstanding, not to say Democrats aren't racist, both are problems. And, Aaron, we have like literally a minute and a half.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. Just in terms of Trump, the election, and the women question, look, the typical voter now is a woman, okay? They account for the majority of voters. Secondly, Trump has an astonishing negative 53% gap among unmarried women. You know, the guy is an out-and-out misogynist, and women aren't dumb. People are going to flee him in droves. I think you're even going to see the establishment fleeing him. They're already playing. They already have their plan B in action. That's why Paul Ryan is working overtime to try and shore up the House, why he's refusing to run. He doesn't want to go down in flames. But, you know, I don't think this is going to be a decisive election in terms of a real realignment. We'll have to see a fundamental shaking out between left and right in the coming election. I hope we move towards a more cooperative rather than more divisive policies in the way of Trump and the Republicans.
Aaron, you've had the last word today. Aaron Gupta, Catalina Byrd, Eugene Craig III. Great discussion. Really
absolutely,
lively. I appreciate you all being here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And on the way to our next conversation, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. So we have to end the conversation here. It's been a great conversation. When we come back, the Mark Steiner Show producer, Mark Gunnery, sits down with City Paper Deputy Editor Brandon Soderberg to talk about what's in the City Paper this week. Stay with us.